I'm just going to begin by reading a little bit from Alice Through the Looking Glass. I'll explain why in a moment. So we have Alice Through the Looking Glass, which is slightly less well-known than Alice in Wonderland, begins with Alice having a conversation with a kitten. And she's standing with the kitten just before a mirror. And what Alice says to the kitten is this: "Let's pretend that you're the Red Queen, Kitty. You know, I think if you sat up and folded your arms, you'd look exactly like her. Now do try, there's a dear." Now Alice got the Red Queen off the table and set it up before the kitten as a model for it to imitate. However, the thing didn't succeed. Principally, Alice said, because the kitten wouldn't fold its arms properly. So to punish it, she held it up to the looking glass that it might see how sulky it was. "And if you're not good directly," she added, "I'll put you through into Looking Glass House. How would you like that? Now, if you'll only attend, Kitty, and not talk so much, I'll tell you all my ideas about Looking Glass House. First, there's the room you can see through the glass. That's just the same as our drawing room, only the things go the other way. I can see all of it when I get upon a chair, all but the bit behind the fireplace. Though I do wish I could see that bit. I want so much to know whether they've a fire in the winter. You can never tell, you know, unless our fire smokes, and then smoke comes up in that room too. But that might only be pretense, just to make it look as if they had a fire. Well, and the books are something like our books, only the words go the wrong way. I know that because I've held up one of our books to the glass, and then they hold up one in the other room. How would you like to live in Looking Glass House, Kitty? I wonder if they'd give you milk there. But perhaps Looking Glass milk isn't good to drink. But oh, Kitty, now we come to the passage. You can see a little peep of the passage in Looking Glass House if you leave the door of our drawing room wide open. And it's very like our passage as far as you can see, only you know it might be quite different on beyond. Oh, Kitty, how nice it would be if we could only get through into Looking Glass House. I'm sure it's got such beautiful things in it. Let's pretend there's a way of getting through into it somehow, Kitty. Let's pretend the glass has got all soft like gauze so that we can get through. Why, it's turned into a sort of mist now. I declare, it'll be easy enough to get through. She was up on the chimney piece while she said this, though she hardly knew how she'd got there, and certainly the glass was beginning to melt away like a bright silvery mist. In another moment, Alice was through the glass and jumped down lightly into the looking glass room. The very first thing she did there was to look and see whether there was a fire in the fireplace, and she was quite pleased to find there was a real one, blazing away as brightly as the one she had left behind. "So I shall be as warm here as I was in the old room," thought Alice. "Warmer, in fact, because there'll be no one here to scold me away from the fire. But what fun it'll be when they see me through the glass in here and can't get at me." Then she began looking about and noticed that what could be seen from the old room was quite common and uninteresting, but that all the rest was as different as possible. For instance, the pictures on the wall next to the fire seemed to be all alive. And the very clock on the chimneypiece, you know you can only see the back of it in the looking glass, had got the face of a little old man and grinned at her. "They don't keep this room so tidy as the other," Alice thought to herself, as she noticed several of the chessmen down in the hearth among the cinders. But in another moment, with a little oh of surprise, she was down on her hands and knees watching them. The chessmen were walking about two and two. "Here are the Red King and the Red Queen," said Alice. "And there are the White Queen and the White King sitting on the edge of the shovel. And here are two castles walking arm in arm." Now, I don't know if, as a kid, if you looked into mirrors, and I think most kids do. And because kids are just very in their senses, I mean, that's a beautiful description, really, in that book of what happens when kids look into a mirror. But it's also, Lewis Carroll was really good at, both in Alice in Wonderland, actually, and in this book, of really describing the same territory that we've been looking into in quite childlike, quite contemporary kind of terms. Because what she's looking at there is that journey into the other world, into the inside, into the internal, into the deep imagination. And you've got this great description of her kind of looking into the mirror and looking at it from one side, but then you see this plate where the boundary between the worlds becomes a bit malleable, and then she moves through to the other side of the experience. In a certain sense, she steps into the imaginal. And what she finds there is a world that's actually quite alive. Just like when we perform meditations or we go on imaginal journeys, you find the images don't stay still. It's a less fixed, much more kind of fluid kind of world. Now, in the poem, the poem Prithayanun is a journey into the deep, into Anuvan. And one of the ways the Celts used to do that a lot was they used to sit by the sea, or they'd sit by pools, or they'd sit by lakes, or they'd imagine themselves going down into the earth. So it's this idea of going into something, crossing a boundary. Now, in the Alice in Wonderland, Alice in Looking Glass story, the boundary is just the mirror. It's just as simple as looking in a mirror and going through a mirror, imagining herself through the mirror. And then looking at what she sees, and somewhere, it's that place where you start to experience your own internal world. And what Lewis Carroll is showing us there is that kind of childlike quality. What Alistair has in both the books really is this childlike curiosity. She's not judging or trying to work out. So she looks at things, she talks to things, she makes quite a lot of mistakes normally based on her assumptions, and. But she has a real gift for treating the other world as a real substantial thing. And in a way, that's the crucial attitude in this work. It's a bit like napalming the spiders, right? So rather than thinking, oh, these are just symbolic of something, I should understand them. Actually, spiders appear, you deal with them, you bring up the energy that destroys the evil spiders that are trying to get at you. And the simpler we can be about our inner exploration, the more literal we can be, the more effective the experience is. The problem that often happens around imaginal journeys or imaginal work in general is the more cognitive part of our mind tries to talk ourselves out of it. Right, this means that, or that means that, or the spiders are just something to do with kind of my relationship with authority, or whatever. And instead of realizing, but actually the reality is, you know, here are evil spiders. We have to deal with the evil spiders. Or we have to find the way through an obstacle, past the brambles. You know, I have to work with the brambles and get past and force our way through. And that way we join up the two parts of our being, the outer part of our being and the inner part of our being. These things that I'm recently calling the idea of the body of flesh and blood and form, and the body of the dream. Because we're sort of creating a relationship, if you like, between the known, fixed, solid sense of ourselves and the more unknown sense of ourselves. And what happens there, and what's been happening in this whole course, is a continual conversation between these two parts of our being. Now, as that happens, and it's a bit like the two sides, if we were to look neuropsychologically at it, we would look at the two hemispheres of the brain talking together. Now, the classically, we know that the left-hand hemisphere of the brain in our society is dominant, because our society is predicated upon rationality, upon linearity, and therefore the kind of neurons on the other side of the brain, connected by the corpus callosum, are less used, less developed. So, in a way, that whole cultural development in us has meant that we have a one-sided development of our nature. If you like, we know the kind of solid world. We don't really know the looking glass world so well. Which is why normally that comes up in dreams. And that's why when you go into the 19th century, when if you like, the pendulum had swung so far in the direction of rationality following the 18th century enlightenment, that you start to, what starts to happen, and that's why right at the beginning of psychotherapy, what you start to see is Freud looking at the fact that women's bodies have become paralyzed, so what becomes known as hysterical paralysis. Because in a certain sense, the completely ignoring of the whole other side of life and that whole patriarchal, analytical way of thinking has created a world where the intuitive, the imaginal, even the emotional is completely pushed out of the picture. Now, the pendulum is swinging back, but of course, it's like something is really fixed on an outer arc. Right, when something has got kind of fixed out, gradually it's freeing up, but the general drift of our society still is massively towards the analytical. So we are much less good at really kind of understanding this whole dreamlike intuitive world, much less good than the medieval bards were when they wrote the poems, and it's why their principal way of understanding the world was through poetry and song and gesture. And now our problem as we encounter these other worlds is that, and encounter these other materials, is that we interpret them, of course, from our own perspective. Now, one of the things that I've noticed that I think has gone massively wrong in our time is something that's happened as traditional storytelling. I don't think it's just my prejudice, but it could be. I have to own that I've had quite a number of difficult encounters with storytellers who often over the years have come to my workshops because I'm talking about Welsh stories and myths, and storytellers are attracted to that. And storytellers are among the most difficult people I have to deal with in these kind of groups. And the reason is that while they believe themselves in the main, there are some that are very good, there's some storytellers that are brilliant, but in the main, most storytelling is a branch of the performance arts and the projection outwards of an idea. So what a storyteller will do is create a kind of their particular vision of a traditional story, and they will act it for you, they will tell it to you, they will put it out there. And in a way, that whole kind of approach is that more cognitive world, if you like, that more formed world, annexing and colonizing that intuitive world. Because what the bards would do is that is so not what a bard would do. What a bard would do is put themselves into the state of mind where that kind of looking glass world, that other world, Anuvin, would talk through them. In a certain sense, what they would do is efface their personality, not enhance their personality, and they would allow the story to tell itself in whatever way it wants to tell itself through them without the... I remember once doing something at the centre in Gloucestershire called Hawkwood House, and I told a story, and then somebody else, it was storytelling, somebody else told a story. Now when I tell stories, I'm sort of in the story, and the story is sort of coming through me, and sometimes this pauses because it doesn't come through yet, and I did my thing and enjoyed it, and it went all right. And then watch the person who came directly after me, who did something completely different. I was sort of fascinated because it was so different from what I had just done, where they completely took center stage, they kind of engaged, their energy was going right out. And the story for them was a vehicle for kind of a story for engagement. And that's not wrong at all. I'm not saying that you have to connect with people. But actually, deep connection happens when you're connected as well to the deeper. And almost the problem with that kind of projection outwards is that you're projecting a concept outwards, an idea of the story, my idea of the story. This is Ian's take on the story of Taliesin. As opposed to letting Taliesin tell himself through you. Now, it's a minor thing at some levels, but it's interesting because it indicates a difficulty in this work as we get to know it. Because as we get to know it, we feel it becomes assimilated. into our own knowing, rather than part of the mischievous other world telling itself through us. You know, whenever I do anything, I always go back to first principles. It's a bit like you do, going back to the image of planting the seed. Okay, so you're, obviously you have to reverse it, do all of that, but what you're reaching back into there is the primal inspiration and connecting up with that and speaking from that place. Now you'll do all your preparations, you'll do all that, but in the end it will be the tree and the seed speaking through you that will move and will touch the people. And the big problem that we have in this, you know, rather than, because, you know, for example, giving you, you know, you listen to the other guy's story, right, who's if you had decided, right, I must create a story like that, so I must create the story of Becky and how Becky came to do that, I'm sure it would be quite good, but it would be nothing like as powerful as what you've decided to do, whereas you're reaching to the core image, the core, the origin that comes out of that deep movement in you. And in a way, that's kind of the danger at the end of a course like this, is we get to know a lot about this stuff. But actually, the key thing that has to happen is we have to retain almost that childlike curiosity and connection to this sort of mysterious world that you can never, never kind of quite know. Now, if we go back culturally, so what happens in the 19th century, and this is why dreams become important. Why are dreams so important? Well, dreams are important because it was the only place that deeper part of them, part of the human nature, can speak, because everything else had got completely shut out. And something very extreme is going on in the culture, this idea of hysterical paralysis, which is, you know, it's an astonishing thing to think about when you think about it, that women's bodies were getting literally paralyzed because of the way they were having to live. Now, if you know anything about 19th century Vienna, this is the patriarchy of patriarchies. This is so, women had no role, no rights, no authority, even in their own families. You know, this is the sort of Victorian imperial male at the height of its power. And so, you know, doing tremendous violence to the world, tremendous violence to human nature, tremendous violence to other societies through colonialism. And of course, at home, tremendous violence, because actually you have the, you know, what happens to women in 19th century societies? They are kept as figures in the home if they're wealthy. They're abused in all kinds of ways if they're not wealthy. And there's this tremendous split around sexuality, around so-called morality. And it's the patriarchal mindset with no holds on it at all. And having the mind that has created these powerful technologies, the Industrial Revolution technologies, that can dominate the world. And that mindset is in everything. You know, they did the Olympics in Britain. That wonderful bit. So you've got this wonderful pastoral kind of scene, and then the engineers, the Victorian men in the long hats, come and tear everything up. Well, they're doing that in the psyche as well. They're doing that. They literally did that in the landscape, and they're doing it in the psyche. And so successfully they do it that they create these great external empires, but also there are these internal empires. Where we're dealing with the residue, the images of these old patriarchs, who want us to disbelieve ourselves, because the dangerous aspect of this other part of the mind for the internal plutocrat, to put it that way, is that power gets dispossessed. So, you know, I remember my own childhood, I used to be given books of facts to read. I remember these books very vividly. They were little pink books, and there's loads of facts about science, about, you know, because in the education in the 50s was really about learning a lot, good memory. You had to have a good memory because you had all these exams where you had to write things and answer questions, no multiple choice or anything like that. You had to remember things that you could write down. And so being knowledgeable was very important. And I remember about these little books, right at the top of every page, in huge letters, is the word, knowledge is power. Knowledge is power. And that's almost the mantra. right, of that side of the mind. I have to know, I have to control, I have to be powerful. Now, it's the complete antithesis of the other side that we've been looking at, where in order to experience that world, in order to participate, you have to relax, you have to enter unknowing, and you have to enter into vulnerability in order to be in that world at all. It's right also you have to be protected in that world, because that also is a living world. You know, this is a world where things come alive and can do things. You know, that's the other thing about that little thing with Lewis Carroll, where she enters into a living world. Right? It's not a dead world. It's not fixed and solid. You know, the chessmen don't stay on the board. They wander off. They even wander to the fire. You might have to pluck them out of the fire if you're not careful. And so there's a whole kind of... And so as we address this, we have to learn... In a lot of ways, what we've been doing in these two years is discovering our own ways of dealing with this side of ourselves and this side of the world, and using a lot of these traditional forms where to help us remember what this side of the human heart is like. And it's interesting in some ways. You can see this even in the excerpt with Alice, where she's trying to make a kitten sit with its arms crossed. You know, it's funny, it's something kids do, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's a dress-up kitten and make move. Put them in the pram and sort of, well, I've done it myself. I mean, I've friends leaving the house, I get the cat to wave to them. Cat doesn't really like it, I think, but, you know, I like it. But, no, she's far too old, though, actually. So, but when they were younger, the sort of cats would wave goodbye out the window. it's a fun kid thing. But it illustrates it. But of course, it sort of illustrates that part of the mind, right, where we do want the cats to be little people and not their own. You know, cats, you can't do that with cats. They need to do it for a moment, but then they'll bugger off and leave you alone and sort of sulk. But it illustrates that part of the mind where we don't participate with and cooperate with these kind of deeper kind of energies. And what happens in the dialogue, though, I think, is that as we encounter it's interesting when people start to work with the imagination, work with that intuition, because you get this whole kind of... Broadly, people have got two different sets of conditioning about it. People who are quite resistant to it and suspicious of it, and people who kind of love it and don't like the analytical. Now, the work really has to be to balance both sides of that equation. Now, I came back from Crete, and it was a horrendous bloody journey because EasyJet cancelled the flight and 12 hours late and should have arrived Saturday night, ended up arriving at 4 in the morning at Gatwick. And so by the time I got to Glasgow, knackered and a bit pissed off and hating EasyJet and whatever. So I came to Glasgow because I had to do some shopping. And it's Glastonbury's Beltane ceremony going on. And there's about, I don't know, 2,000 people, something like that. 2,000 people. And one of the, somebody I know really well, who's very clever, he's a very clever smith, actually. He had created a Chinese dragon dance, but these like Celtic dragons with a white dragon and a red dragon. And it's all very beautiful. It's really kind of amazing, lots of it. I can't really handle it because I'm a bit knackered. On the one hand, it's an amazing thing to do, and it is an amazing thing to do. But what's interesting about it is that it's a very, again, something that's become very, very externalized and very kind of... And it wasn't that the thing was wrong, but what seemed to be going on there is people couldn't get enough of it. They, rather than have the experience and let it go, it was becoming more and more manic, and there was a sort of spinning out thing that can happen. So there's something about that movement between the outside and the inside and the need for balance there. You know, and partly it's just there's all these people and drumming, Glastonbury and drummers. No. I hate fucking drummers. Anyone who's got a fucking drum believes they have the right to beat their drum. It's astonishing, you know. I mean, actually, good drumming. Don't get me wrong. I love good drumming. I mean, you get these troops that come along, drumming troops. They're phenomenal. I actually love good drumming, but you don't get a lot of that around here, really. What you get is somebody who's just bought a drum and I'm beating my bloody drum to whatever rhythm I fancy, really. And I'll do it for as long as I want, which could be for hours and hours. And it's just, and so there are all these bloody drummers everywhere, random drummers and little groups of drummers kicking off and kind of, and you think, oh, for fuck's sake, you're ruining something that actually has got its own kind of beauty. And if you'd left it alone and then come back to quietness, it would have been stunning. But actually, couldn't leave it alone. And I think there's that sort of, you know, that's the other problem with the imaginal, is you get into the ecstatic space and you don't want to come down. You get high and you don't want to come down from the high. And in a way, you know, what Lewis Carroll is looking at a little bit there in that small excerpt is that crossing of the boundary between these two worlds. And actually, and what the need there is to find a way to balance these two things, so that you have access in a way to the body of the dream, and that the body of the dream can be integrated into the body of flesh. And when that happens, when those two things come together properly, then this third thing starts to happen, and I'm calling the body of mystery, where something more mysterious that is both fluid and substantial starts to happen. So you get insights that are creative insights that are very clear and substantial. But a good example of that is your strap line. Okay? So that comes really out of that experience, and it's speaking to the thing you're gonna do on Monday. And it's not some fluffy, it's a very precise, and yet it has within it the well in well-being. Right? That's a powerful imaginal image. And yet it's very clear, very great, very focused words. It's a really good example of this thing that I'm calling the body of mystery. Something mysterious arises that is both rational and clear and has this sort of imaginal sense of mystery inside it. And the key thing, really, I think, in this work we've been doing these 2 years, is learning to keep doing that, learning to cross that boundary, learning to talk between the two different places, not trying to live in one to the exclusion of the other, but also having to learn to work with the inevitable barriers and obstacles that come up when you try to do that, whether that's brambles or feeling bored, or doubt is one of the big things actually that happens. I'm not getting this right, I'm not doing it right, I've sort of lost it, maybe once I could do it, now I can't. All kinds of, and this is all stuff that's organized, because one of the problems that happens, I'll finish on this because we need to go to lunch, because megalomania is in town today. So we need to get. It's one of these the conference season has started in Glastonbury. This is all about megaliths, and nothing wrong with that. It's fine, but it just means you need to get out and get your lunch before they come out and get theirs. Basically, very straightforward kind of reason. But the problem is, just to end on this, really, the issue that we have to kind of look at is how to keep integrating these two places inside ourselves. And I was going to say something else, but I've forgotten. Never mind. We'll go to lunch instead. Hopefully it'll come back to me.
We must have been down here for the